CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. The Wall Street Journal reporting on the Bruen case, the 6-3 decision in the case, New York State Rifle and Pistol Association Incorporated versus Bruen, marks the widest expansion of gun rights since 2010, when the courts applied nationwide a 2008 ruling establishing an individual right of armed self-defense within the home. I welcome Professor Richard Epstein, the Hoover Institution, a senior fellow. He teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago, to comment on the decision of the Supreme Court 6-3 on the basis of the reading of the Second Amendment of the Constitution dated from the late 18th century and with an addendum in the mid-19th century, the 14th Amendment. Richard, a very good evening to you. I see the new case must be explained in terms of two previous cases by Supreme Courts that are not too distant from us. There's the 2008 case called Heller that was the majority opinion was written by Justice Scalia, joined by Alito, Roberts, Kennedy, and Thomas in 2008. In 2010, it was a 5-4 decision. These are 5-4 decisions. Scalia, again, joined by Kennedy and Roberts and Alito and Thomas. This decision, 6-3, has new members. Scalia is gone. But you remark in a new podcast that while you disagreed with the two earlier decisions, you believed that this present decision, majority written by Justice Thomas with a concurrence written by Justice Kavanaugh, is consistent with the plain language of the Constitution and the Second Amendment. How so? Good evening to you, Professor.
Okay, look, it's a very complicated story. Let me start with reading the Second Amendment, because it begins on a rather strange and somewhat discordant note. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. This clause has two parts to it. It has the militia part, and then it has the substantive right. Historically, if you read this in context with the rest of the Constitution, most notably those provisions in Article 1, which talk about the distribution of powers over the state militias, they're under local control until they are called up into national service, and therefore the federal government has an interest in standardizing how they do it. And the Second Amendment was essentially designed within the historical context to make sure that the federal government could not limit the way in which the states organized and designed their militia. If that's correct, and I think it is historically, and it gives way to all the words in the Constitution, Heller is clearly wrong, because there's no federal-state relationship there. It's only about the District of Columbia.
Heller
is
the 2008 decision. Go ahead.
Decision. Yeah. And the McDonald decision on incorporation is very difficult to say that if the whole purpose of the Second Amendment is to protect state autonomy, and then we're going to reread this thing to say that, in fact, the federal government, the Constitution, protects individuals against the state. It wasn't designed that.
So McDonald is the 2010 decision. Please continue.
That's right. So what Scalia did is he read the first clause of this thing as complete surplusage and struck it out. And so now the amendment seems to read, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It sounds very absolute. Well, that can't be correct. And so what Scalia says is, no, the state always is allowed to justify arms restriction. And then the question is, what's the standard? And the standard that he put forward was an intermediate scrutiny standard, which means you always start with the right to keep and to bear arms, and the state has to show some substantial reason why it is that its imposition of a given regulation will advance a legitimate state purpose, and it can't be frivolous, it has to be serious. So that's the standard. We come to this case, and it's clear that Thomas and Alito and the majority of six is trying to apply that standard of intermediate scrutiny. It's clear when you read the Breyer dissent that he says, this thing is so utterly compensated that all these judgments should be made by the state legislature. And so Thomas is applying intermediate scrutiny, and it turns out that Breyer is applying a hugely deferential standard. If you apply the hugely deferential standard, you don't need to look at anything. I mean, guns are always a risk, and so therefore anything that restricts their use is always a benefit. The position of the majority was, I think, more nuanced and correct in my view. You look at this particular rule, and what does it say? It says, well, I mean, you can bear arms That's carrying him outside. But only if you could show a special justification above and beyond that for all other citizens that you needed for defense. So you could carry a weapon if it turns out there's somebody who's stalking you, maybe. But you can carry a weapon if you're just worried about the fact that you live in a high crime district. And at this particular point, the question you're going to have to ask is whether this regulation is in fact going to be some kind of a threat to public safety, that is the use of these guns. And I'd be very hard-pressed to say that. I mean, all the people who apply for these applications, the people who take courses in gun training and so forth, none of them are obvious criminals. There is at least a chance that the gun will be used to defend either the person who is attacked or some third person. So self-defense is always there. And so then you're trying to figure out, well, is this going to work? And you start citing the Sullivan Law in New York City. And it turns out that in places with high crimes, you see very restrictive uses on guns. These laws are systematically ignored by the gangs and the thugs who want to do it, and they're respected by ordinary people. So the argument on the other side has always gone something like this. It doesn't matter how many guns there are in circulation. The last thing you want to do is to remove guns from law-abiding citizens who will follow the law, whereas the thugs and the crooks and the gangsters will not. And so it is not a rational rule. In fact, what Justice Breyer says is there have been 44,000 gun deaths. That number is a bit misleading because 21,000 of these deaths or so, about over half, I think is in fact suicide cases. Then it turns out that there's a substantial number of guns that are killing. There are few accidental deaths, but it's the public street killings. And if you then ask yourself the question, if this guy carries a pistol outside in a concealed holster, what's it going to do to the rate of deaths from guns? And I think the answer is negligible at best, one way or the other. And if it is going to have an effect, it's more likely that this particular rule will reduce the level of crime rather than increase it. And so the legislature, what you need for the state to do when it passes this thing is to put on the record explanations as to why it thinks that this is appropriate. And the record is bare of any of those justifications. Justice Breyer said, oh, send this case back and we'll do all this kind of hearing again. I don't think the state could actually do it. And I think that the way in which you want to deal with these things is if you pass legislation. You just don't pass the legislation and say, trust me. You pass the legislation and you give a decent account as to why this thing is going to work in the way in which you said it's going to work. And as far as I can see, they haven't done this. So I don't regard this as a particularly difficult case. I mean, there are many complicated cases. You know, can you carry guns into schools, public theaters and arenas and stuff like that? Who is going to carry them? I mean, just for example, take a situation in a school. It's clear that you would obviously justify a rule which says that no kid can come to school at age 17 carrying a concealed weapon. I mean, that would be crazy. But at the same point, can a teacher who has been a former military person or a former policeman or a current person in any of these capacities carry a gun on campus given the terrible risk that a mass killer will start to come in? And that's a very different question. And so it seems to me, if you take the balancing test that Justice Thomas refers to fairly painfully, what happens is that the use of the guns on the one case may be certainly desirable. The ban in the other case will be there. And it would be a very interesting case as to whether or not in the face of these crimes, it turns out, could the state ban a school, a private school, say, from allowing its teachers to carry guns if they've been trained? I think the answer to that question may well be no. I'm not even sure that the Supreme Court majority would go along with it, but at least that's the kind of case that you want to have an inquiry on. This one, I think, is too easy. I just don't think it's that way, and I think what's happened is a semi-hysterical reaction about how the world is going to come to end. If you want to stop mass killings, the last thing you want to do is to have the police sit outside a building when a gunman is stalking children inside, and they refuse to enter. I mean, it's not against the Second Amendment for people to enter in and stop this guy from killing. I mean, I just...
I want to speak of the concurrence by Justice Kavanaugh, because this requires me to understand the uses of concurrence. When you concur with the majority, but you're adding additional...
But the Kavanaugh, or was it Alito?
In a concurring opinion, Justice Kavanaugh, joined by Chief Justice Roberts, stressed that permitting laws in more than 40 states remain valid because these laws in 40 states, evaluate applicants based on objective criteria, rather than granting discretion to officials regarding an individual's justification for carrying a concealed weapon. The reason I'm keen on this, first of all, to understand what weight a concurrence has, but also because the 1913 law in New York talked about good character, which is the language of 1913 is another universe from where we are today, who is and who is not a good character. It seems so arbitrary, it's unenforceable. 40 states use what the court calls objective criteria. Does that open now to New York State, but there are seven others, I believe, that their the legislatures can take control of this and write laws and pass laws that are consistent with the 40 other states?
Look, obviously, if you see a concurrence doing this, they're signaling, as they often want to signal, that there is a limit to what we have done. Please do not overread this case. And I think it's perfectly clear that the game is not over with respect to what's going to happen in New York State. The governor is very progressive. She's surely going to try to pass another legislation.
Governor Hochul says she's calling the legislature back into session
At this point, they can certainly try again. I mean, the question of what they do, of course, is not going to be free from constraint. And if they simply make cosmetic changes in the earlier statute, it will be struck down a second time. But if, on the other hand, they bring it in conformity with cases where the two justices say, we think this is fine, well, I could still add, if you have the three dissenters who would surely uphold this law and you have at least two others who are going to uphold the law, it's 5-4 in favor of the statute. And in fact, that's generally what ought to be done. It seems to me that rather than trying to break new ground in which there's serious constitutional complications, if there is a safe harbor that you can enter as the state in order to impose these regulations, do that. And then after you get further information as to how this law is played out, you may want to amend them given the strength of the additional information that you get when the law is put into effect. So I don't regard this as the end. Look, there's a parallel here to the abortion cases, right? We know what it's likely to happen and so forth. And what's going to happen is it's not going to be the end of Roe v. Wade. The states are going to be told that you can do what you want. Many states will pass statutes that basically embody Roe. There'll be some states that will decide their own courts can handle this thing. And so Roe will be a protected right under state constitutions, even if not under the federal constitution. So treat this as part of a long game, and it has somewhat different significance. Now, there's another point, I think, which is important, which is the Breyer standard, which says, you know, it's complicated, defer it to the legislature, has been authoritatively rejected. And I think correctly so. Nobody would say that, oh, my God, whatever the legislature wants in areas of speech, it should be able to get. If you have that standard, oh, complexity means that there's no constitutional protection, we might as well repeal the Bill of Rights and start over again in some other way. So what's going to happen in all of these cases is you want these states to be on notice that there is some limit on what they can do. The whole purpose of putting a Bill of Rights in is to control the excesses of a democratic government. And it would be just preposterous to say in a state as politically charged as New York that the democratic excesses never could possibly happen. So what's going to happen is if you use the intermediate scrutiny, all future gun laws are going to be subject to some degree of constitutional challenge. That is not a sea change. That was what was supposed to have been done in Heller. My view is Heller was wrong for the reasons I mentioned. But if, in fact, we're working within the framework that you ignore the militia relationship and just talk about the right of people to keep and bear arms, then it's the level of scrutiny is going to have to be higher. And I think the Breyer position is just wrong. Could you imagine somebody saying, well, we have these rules on political speech, and what we now want to do is to say that anybody who wants to speak on a public square can be banned because the legislature has determined how complicated a matter this really is, and it thinks that all demonstrations in public parks should be illegal.
Let's go to Maine. Let's go to Maine, Richard. Let's go to Maine.
Okay, let's go to Maine.
There's a freedom of speech
issue.
As
Maine goes, so goes the nation.
It connects. I'm speaking to Professor Richard Epstein, and we're reflecting upon recent decisions by the United States Supreme Court. We have another decision about the state of Maine. Carson decided 6-3, and it turns on the First Amendment, freedom of speech and freedom of religion. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.